for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Audiobooks have come a long way in the past 7 decades. Today, we can download a digital book to our smartphone in minutes and listen to it anywhere. But the first talking books for the blind required a special phonograph machine, and a typical novel took up several double-sided records. Here's a clip from one of the first recordings in 1935.
The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie. Read by Laidman Brown. Chapter 1. Dr. Shepherd at the breakfast table. Mrs. Ferrars died on the night of the 16th-17th of September, a Thursday.
Joining me in the studio to talk about the latest trends in audiobooks, John Schwartz of The New York Times, and award-winning narrator Catherine Kellgren. Joining me from NPR's New York City studio, Peter Osnos of Public Affairs Books and the Century Foundation, and joining us from Seattle, Michelle Cobb of the Audio Publishers Association and AudioGo. I know many of you enjoy audiobooks. I hope you'll join our conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you all with us. I must say, hearing that excerpt from the first recording with Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd was such fun. But Michelle Cobb, give us the evolution of audiobooks.
Well, that's a great question. You know, when I started in the audio world, it was all about cassettes. My first job was actually in audio, was packing cassettes into boxes and sending them off to libraries. And we've seen over the past decade a real transition. We went from cassette to CD, and now we're in the process of moving from CD to download. And what's great is throughout that whole process, we're continuing to serve customers that are used to a different format, and we're continuing to evolve. And really, over the last 3 years, we've seen an absolute explosion in the number of titles that are being produced. So many years ago, it was really a small fraction of the number of books that were being put into audio. And today, it's over 7,000 titles per year making it onto audio. And that was just in 2011. We know the numbers from 2012 will be a big explosion beyond that.
That's wonderful to hear. Peter Osnos, talk about why there is this big explosion of audiobooks today.
Well, as with so many things in the world of information and entertainment communications, it has a lot to do with technology. You can do wonderful things now with audiobooks downloadable. You can do wonderful things with audiobooks as CDs. You could take something like Robert Caro's classic a book about Lyndon Johnson, which is, if I'm not mistaken, 33 hours and 27 CDs.
Wow.
But what a fabulous way to appreciate what Robert Caro did, because you can concentrate and really focus on every word of the book. And the book itself, of course, is an epic. And that's one way to do it. You could also do it, as I said, as a download, and you can have it,
sure.
And you can even have it delivered to you digitally if you are blind. There are now ways in which I have a very close friend who's blind and who listens to books that he could never have accessed before at a speed that we would not be able to comprehend. But he can listen to the way the digital frame goes at a velocity that allows him to read a book of this kind maybe in half the time.
John Schwartz, who's listening?
Well, it's everyone, including me. I mean, you know, I love audiobooks, and we're sort of a tribe out there. We carry these books on our iPods, on our iPhones. I'm wearing my iPod on my arm
Oh my.
As a watch, and it's got Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl on it right now, and I was listening to David Copperfield before that and Bring Up the Bodies. I carry it with me everywhere.
So what does that mean? Do you walk around this way with your arm?
It looks like Dick Tracy, but I don't actually have to do that. I have just a cord with earbuds, and I connect it to the watch. It looks like a watch. It's the iPod on a watch band.
What do you think the appeal is, Catherine?
Well, I think it's a way to interact with literature that is very unique. There's something very intimate about having a story read aloud to you, and you absorb information in a different way. And it feeds wanting to buy books and read them in print, and it allows people who are driving, jogging, doing housework to absorb information and enjoy books in a special, different medium.
You know, it's interesting. I think it may go back to childhood. That is, you talk about liking to be read to, and I think people really do enjoy that. How did you first become involved in reading books aloud?
Well, when I was a child, I was obsessed with listening to audiobooks, and my father would also read aloud to me. And I discovered the work of a lot of my favorite authors via listening to audiobooks. I mean, I think there's an argument out there that if you're a child and you're listening to audiobooks, that it's somehow cheating, that you're not reading, and that it will cause you not to pick up a print book. But I think it's the exact opposite. It made me curious about literature, and it made me pick up in print form the works of authors I heard on audio. So when I grew older and after I studied drama, I felt that, you know, this was an important part of an actor's job, was working in this kind of medium. And I think it's because it's relatively new. We haven't had a dedicated audiobook company for very long. I think the first one was 1950s. It was Cadman Audio. And since then, the medium has been growing and building. But I think it's still, relatively speaking, fairly new.
And Michelle, where does audio fit into the overall book marketplace?
Well, we are, you know, a part of the big publishing family. And there's really two sets and types of audio publishers out there. Those that are part of a print book publisher and those that are independent and really just work in audio. And, you know, we're a subset of each of those sales. But as we've talked about here, you know, people that are listening are people that are readers. And, you know, we're really considering ourselves a part of that family and pushing book publishers to recognize the format and to really excite authors and excite readers about trying audiobooks. We always say if you can get one person to try an audiobook, they're going to come back for more.
John, from your point of view, what makes a great audiobook?
Well, the narrator has to be both completely present but not overbearing, and has to understand the work. There are people who do a brilliant job at that, and it takes story as well. But, you know, I love nonfiction works. I love the great works of fiction. I love trashy novels. So I'm probably not the best person to ask, because I've listened to almost anything.
Okay, let's hear one excerpt of a book that probably became one of the most popular and really demonstrates character voices.
Professor McGonagall had broken away from the spectators, marched straight up to Professor Trelawney, and was patting her firmly on the back while withdrawing a large handkerchief from within her robes. "There, there, Sybil, calm down. Blow your nose on this. It's not as bad as you think now. You're not going to have to leave Hogwarts."
"Oh, really, Professor McGonagall?" said Umbridge in a deadly voice, taking a few steps forward. "And your authority for that statement is..."
"That would be mine," said a deep voice. The oak front doors had swung open. Students beside them scuttled out of the way as Dumbledore appeared in the entrance.
And Catherine, that truly represents the ability of the reader to move in and out of different characters.
Absolutely. Jim Dale is one of my biggest heroes.
And, of course, he was reading from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. Is Jim Dale one of the most popular readers?
Absolutely. And he's a great reader for children's audio because he has this lovely, warm narrative voice that draws the listener in, and then he's able to differentiate between all the characters so clearly and with such humor and intelligence that it really just brings the story right off the page.
Peter Alice knows there's been lots of criticism, perhaps more in the past than now, that listening to a book is not the same as reading a book. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would actually disagree with that completely, or fairly thoroughly. I actually think that listening to a book allows you to concentrate on it in a way that very often is not possible when you're dealing with the printed page or a page on a screen, because the tendency to skim, particularly in a great, big, long, complex nonfiction book, is pretty strong. Whereas when you're listening to it, you are absorbing it. I mean, think about the way people listen to radio. They listen to radio with a degree of focus, we know, that they probably don't do when they are watching television or doing some other things. It's always been striking to me. I listen primarily when I'm driving. It's always been striking to me how much easier it is for me to concentrate on all those wonderful stories and all those wonderful material.
Peter S. knows he's founder and editor at large of Public Affairs Book. He's also contributing correspondent with TheAtlantic.com. I know many of you would like to weigh in on audiobooks. We'll try to get to as many of your calls as possible. Here's an interesting comment from Don Taylor, who says, after reading a good book, I have years later listened to the audiobook, usually listen in the gym or on long drives. Just the take of the reader is another valuable view of the author's message. John, I know there is a story about an author himself who was converted to audiobooks.
Well, I've written a few columns for the Times Book Review about audiobooks, and I generally talk to authors in preparing for them and say, so have you listened to your audiobooks? And they tend to say, no, I wrote it. I don't need to hear it. And I'm worried that if I listen to it, then I won't like it. I'll want to nitpick it. And I was talking with Gary Steingart, who's written Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story, and just a tremendous novelist. And he was saying that he really didn't think that he would like listening to an audiobook. And I sent him a couple of files from Super Sad True Love Story. And we were sending this back and forth in email. And he said, Oh my God, she's completely gotten across everything I was trying to say.
Huh.
And he was thrilled by this. And he said, I don't know if he's listening to audiobooks today, but he certainly was converted to the idea that this is a valuable way to receive, to take in a book.
Michelle, talk about how narrators are chosen.
Well, that's a great question. We really try to work with the text to determine what the point of view of the book is. You know, you often have a narrator playing male and female characters, so you have to find someone who has the right tone of voice, someone who can slide between the sexes easily, and who can bring senses of tension and drama in the right places. So there's a lot of elements that you look at. And one of the things we find with authors when they actually want to record their own book is, as they're reading it, they sometimes want to change things and, you know, make some alterations. And that's always a challenge when you're trying to produce an unabridged book that will match the original text.
Let's hear a reading from The Great Gatsby.
There was dancing now on the canvas in the garden. Old men pushing young girls backward in eternal, graceless circles, superior couples holding each other tortuously, fashionably, and keeping in the corners, and a great number of single girls dancing individualistically or relieving the orchestra for a moment of the burden of the banjo or the traps. By midnight, the hilarity had increased. A celebrated tenor had sung in Italian, and a notorious contralto had sung in jazz. And between the numbers, people were doing stunts all over the garden, while happy, vacuous bursts of laughter rose toward the summer sky.
And, of course, that was Frank Mueller reading from The Great Gatsby. You know, it would seem, John, that there are challenges to the person who's reading a book to change the tone, to change the approach, to change the nuance with each voice.
This is what I found when I narrated my own book, that I had written this book. I went into the studio to do the audio recording, and there's a natural inclination to say the same things, to use the same rhythm in a sentence, to use the same intonation, to end on a low instead of on a high. And the producer would come in and say, "Now, John, you're getting a little repetitive. Let's go back." So I learned that challenge firsthand.
John Schwartz is national correspondent for the New York Times. He is he recently narrated his own memoir, Oddly Normal. What about you, Catherine? That's a real challenge, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so much involved in audio narration and so much sort of careful research and preparatory work goes into.
Like what?
Well, when I'm preparing an audiobook, after I read it through at home for the first time, I go through, I make note of any accents or dialects that I might need to do correctly. I even have a dialect coach that I'll work with. There'll be a series of words that I'll need to look up how to pronounce. I'll think about the different characters' voices and what I can draw on for that. Sometimes I do a whole series that involves a lot of songs. It's a series for children, and they're a sort of adventure series, and they have sea shanties and folk ballads. And I go back and I find the original tunes for all the songs. So a lot is involved in putting a book together.
You know, it's interesting. After I wrote my own memoir, I, too, narrated it, I found myself learning new things as I read the book, even after having written it. Did that happen to you, John?
Well, it certainly happened to me. I first of all, you're exploring your feelings in a way that that simply writing in a solitary way late at night, it doesn't necessarily come across. And I found myself having to pause. I found myself having to take breaks. The story is the memoir of my son's suicide attempt and our attempt as a family to come together, help him get past it. And so there were moments when I just had to stop reading for a while and pull myself back together. Now, on the other hand, it's got a happy ending. So,
but did the book help you? Did reading it help you?
Reading the book felt like therapy in some ways. Just walking through it, not just writing it, but then saying every word aloud.
Yeah.
It was tremendous in that way.
We have something of Catherine Kellgren reading here. She is, of course, American, But in this, you are reading with an English accent.
He told the raven the story. He held back nothing. Then he waited. The raven's response was not long in coming. "As I have already observed," said Maldwin, "you're a cat, an alley cat, an infernal subspecies. I know your kind. Look at me." He held up his crippled wing, once broken, now poorly mended. He strutted and stumbled forward closer to Skilly, then thrust his beak into his face. "And it took a cowardly gang of your friends to do this. Yes, I know your kind."
And that is Catherine Kellgren reading in an English accent from the Cheshire Cheese Cat. How much coaching did you have to have?
Oh, well, I mean, I lived in England for a good portion of my life.
I see.
I went to drama school there. I studied regional dialects there. So that's kind of my home ground, in a way. I mean, I have to go further afield for different accents. It's interesting that you played that little section. That's a very grand raven from the Tower of London, who's not amused. The cat has been questioning him. But that voice for the raven is inspired. You were playing Jim Dale earlier doing Harry Potter.
Yes.
And he was doing, I think it was, Professor McGonagall. I am imitating there, and I saw him reading, and he said he is imitating there Dame Edith Evans, who I used to listen to recordings of. She was famous for playing Lady Bracknell and for saying, "A handbag." She's such a distinct voice. I think a lot of narrators copy her.
All right, and Peter, let me turn to you. What about the choice of narrators as opposed to authors reading their own books? What are your thoughts?
That's a really interesting question. Authors reading their own books is tricky because some people who can write well don't necessarily read well. And I think you have to have a very straightforward conversation with an author who wants to read his or her own book and say, "Look, let's try it and see how it works." I think most of the books you've been talking about here are essentially entertainment, Harry Potter, Great Gatsby. The fact is that there are a lot of books which are, these days, which are published by, say, university presses and can be very, very helpful for people who listen to them on their smartphones or as they, you know, navigate around their worlds. And sometimes in those cases, the narration is less important than it is for people to simply focus on the subject at hand. Mm. And what you want to do is get people to be aware of what they're listening to and to accept the fact that this isn't theatrics, that it is, in fact, information. And sometimes in the right circumstances, that can be an enormously valuable asset to the person who is able to listen to something, in effect, reading a book that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
Let's hear a very successful author reading his own work.
When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood, and worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. People everywhere brag and whimper about the woes of their early years, but nothing can compare with the Irish version. The poverty, the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother moaning by the fire, pompous priests, bullying schoolmasters, the English, and the terrible things they did to us for 800 long years.
And that was, of course, Frank McCourt reading from his autobiography, Angela's Ashes. Peter, I would think you would agree that that was a perfect match.
Oh, boy, is it ever. and that is, I think, one of the wonderful things about audiobooks. When you get it right, somebody like Frank McCourt, or Jim Dale doing the Harry Potter. It enhances the experience of reading the book in a really very unique and I think enormously important way. What I wanted was trying to do before is also to distinguish that there are categories of audiobooks, particularly in today's world, which are less about entertainment and maybe less about what the pleasure of listening than it is about the absorption of information. And we can do that. We can be trained to do that in a way that is really, I think, extremely valuable for people who are, you know, traveling around and who need to get masses of information and may not be able to do it all on screens. They want to have it delivered to them as they're on their treadmill or as they're in their car.
Peter Osnos, and he is founder and editor at large of Public Affairs Books. He's a media fellow at Century Foundation and contributing correspondent with TheAtlantic.com. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Michelle, we haven't talked about the costs of manufacturing audiobooks. Can you address that?
Sure. The real cost of making an audiobook is actually, before you get to making any physical product, acquiring the rights to record the title, and then actually recording the title. You want to have a top-notch narrator, you want to have a good producer, and then you have to take into account the artwork. Oftentimes we want to make it look like the print book so it's recognizable. So all of those things happen before you even print a box or print a CD. And obviously the digital download world has changed that because you don't have to think about, well, how many copies of this am I going to sell on CD and how many of those are going to return to me? And I don't have to think quite so much about the manufacturing cost. We really spend more time on thinking about delivery costs. So we're trying to adapt and change with the shifting market while recognizing that the important piece is creating a great recording.
Peter, do you want to weigh in?
Well, I think for many years, audiobooks were deterred by the fact that they were more expensive on the whole than the printed book. Because of all of the extra costs that went involved with the production, the manufacture, the shipping, and so on and so forth. So you would, let's say, if a printed book was $25, the audiobook could sometimes be $40 or $45. I think recently, because of the way in which the industry and technology has evolved, it's no longer necessary to produce these things in large, cumbersome boxes and send them around to by trucks and have them come back. You can do the thing through downloads. And that has brought the cost down. I think in bringing the cost down, it has made it substantially more available because people, as is so often the case, when they look and they say, well, you know, do I want to spend the extra dollar or two that it will cost to get an audiobook now as distinct from when in the past it was $15 or $20? And yes, the answer is they probably do. And I think that's one of the reasons why you do see a substantial increase in the number of books that are available on audiobooks and the amount that people are reading them.
But do I understand, and John, you may want to weigh in on this as well, that there are concerns about monopoly by a few producers and distributors, Peter?
Well, yeah. If what you're referring to is Amazon and the way in which Amazon has come to dominate the audiobook market as it has in other respects, I actually think that there are a great many ways in which books are, because of technology again, are being made available that will challenge the ultimate Amazon dominance. So pleased that it is possible now, instead of waiting for months and months, because you can take a digital tape, if you're willing to listen to it, you can take a digital tape and convert it into an audiobook very quickly. And you don't have to go through so many of the multiple steps. Again, I'm drawing a distinction, which some of the other folks on the panel are not, between what is essentially entertainment and say quality information of a certain kind, and the more technical or the kinds of academic or scholarly,
right,
or even, you know, serious nonfiction, which in the past would not have been done. I actually started a project a few years ago, supported by Carnegie and MacArthur, and we went to university presses and said, look, we would like to do audiobooks with you. And we found that very few of them had ever done an audiobook. They didn't have any idea. And one of the things we discovered was that one factor was that they were too expensive. So we were able, using the money that we had with these foundations, to experiment to do these kinds of books as audiobooks. And it worked very nicely.
Excellent. All right. Short break here. When we come back, we'll open the fountains, read your email. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. military came to embrace counterinsurgency as an approach to the fighting in Iraq and why it's failed in Afghanistan. We'll talk with journalist and historian Fred Kaplan, author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Join us.
And welcome back as we talk about and enjoy listening to some excerpts of audiobooks. Let's go to the phones now. First to Wiley, Texas. Hi there, Jessica.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
First, I want to say I appreciate your show and all you do.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that my husband and I avidly listen to audiobooks for many years now, and one of the reasons is that my husband has a reading disability, dyslexia, and audiobooks has really opened up the world of books for him in a whole nother level, and we can actually share each evening of books we're both reading together. My question is there a need or a market for audiobooks for disabilities? And also, have any of the guests today heard about graphic audios, the kind of movies in your mind?
Michelle.
Well, definitely there is a need served by audiobooks for people who struggle with reading, whether they be young people or whether they be full-scale adults. And, you know, we're pleased to be able to ensure that anyone can read a book.
And one of the things I think that people often think is, well, you know, they used to think it was really audiobooks are from the or for the blind or for people that are learning English, and they're not. And because we're making so many more, we can serve everybody who struggles with reading a print book, and we can serve a whole set of entertainment. And one thing I will say, you know, for children who are learning to read, not only does it support a struggling reader, but it really helps increase the comprehension of readers who are well above their grade level. So it's an exciting piece to be part of something that can be helping people as well as entertaining people.
And here's a follow-up from Kara in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, please.
Right on that. I teach students with dyslexia, and I'm an English teacher who's often thought that I might be interested in teaching just adult learning classes. And I've thought frequently about books on tape or just audio learning, I mean, audiobooks. And I've thought that they would be really useful in a classroom, because students could hear them and benefit from them, all kinds of students, maybe people who were too busy to, you know, read or whatever. But it would be great if those students had the book to look at so that when they were in class discussing it, we could say, okay, turn to page 102 and look at paragraph 3 when the person says whatever. So there would be that connection.
Catherine.
Well, that's very interesting, because I know a lot of librarians and teachers are using audiobooks in the classroom. And in fact, just this last year, the American Library Association published two books, which were guides for librarians and teachers about youth audiobooks. And, you know, it is an incredibly important component to learning to read, is being read aloud to. It increases children's vocabularies. People often find that children, when they come to read aloud with more fluidity and expression if they've been read to or listened to audiobooks. So it's just a very important piece of the puzzle.
Here's an email from Kelly in Indianapolis, who says, listening to audiobooks helped my kids who couldn't yet read chapter books learn to love stories like The Chronicles of Narnia and the popular Magic Treehouse series. Now in fourth grade and kindergarten, my oldest two so look forward to staying up late on Saturday nights listening to a story on the iPod while building with Legos. Audiobooks have helped them develop a long attention span, heighten their comprehension skills, and most important, have fostered a deep love for reading. John.
Well, I think that that is wonderful. I don't think that I have a reading disability, but I do know that stuff that comes through my ears sticks with me in a way that that reading, you know, that coming through my eyes, it doesn't. And so so it's a different way of taking in information, and it's wonderful. To get back to Peter Osnos' idea, some of the best experiences I've had have been with nonfiction works that just inform me in a very undramatic way. John Gardner's great History of Bell Labs is a fantastic read.
David McCullough's Truman, for
tremendous.
Example.
And hearing Grover Gardner do the Robert Caro, unbelievable.
If I could just jump in.
Sure.
One of the things that has been striking to me, as I said, I've been following this through this close friend who years ago would have to wait sometimes months for books to become available to him on records and then eventually on cassettes. And then he called me and he said, but why can't we just take the digital tapes? I'm willing to listen to digital tapes, and to make a relatively long story shorter, he's now able to just get anything almost immediately as when it's released, as long as he's willing to do it his way, which is not necessarily the way that you would want to listen to, because it sounds like jabber. But in fact, for him, he's trained himself so he can really benefit and appreciate the quality of what he of the information that he's getting. It's a huge, wonderful change for someone who is disabled in that way.
Well, and let me say also that the market has really changed. You know, we as publishers, when we first were emerging, were not simultaneously producing the audiobook along with the book. And now, a really high portion of what we do is ensuring that the audiobook and the print book are available at the same time, because we don't want anyone to have that lag or delay.
And here's an email from Megan who asks, are audiobooks going to compete with ebooks, or will there be a bigger push to make ebook devices audio friendly, since some are not, with the printed book in a quiet decline? Will audiobooks become more prevalent, John?
Well, I think they could. Certainly, it's the barriers to publication are coming down. You're seeing more of them. In fact, you can right now listen to an audiobook and it'll sync up with the same work on your Kindle. And so this, they call it Whisper Sync. But I think that this technology is going to grow. You can pick it up, put it down, listen in the car, and not worry about where you were. Huh. So as it becomes easier to get this stuff, more people will want to get it.
Catherine.
Yeah, it's amazing the advances that are coming through. I mean, the fact that you can read an ebook form and then stop and listen to the audio form of the same book, it's drawing attention to the work that producers and narrators do and the work that goes into making an audiobook has been so important. I mean, I know that there are things like there's going to be an audio festival this summer called Here Now in Kansas City, Missouri, that's going to feature audiobook narration. There's been talk among narrators on both coasts about forming some sort of a narrators guild, so to speak, that could work with the Audio Publishers Association to highlight the work that narrators do to promote audiobooks. I think as the medium expands, public awareness is growing about the value and importance of audiobooks.
All right, to Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello. I have two suggestions for distribution for those of us who don't have good access for downloading. One is to have a bookstore where they can download it to my device. And the other one is to have more of those self-contained playback devices like Playaway. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Peter Osnos, do you see an expansion there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is already that kind of technology in one form or another does already exist. I think that you can pretty much get almost any audiobook now by downloading it from one or another of the retailers. But also there are devices which allow you to listen to a digital reader if that's what you want to have, and that's now quite available. There's also machines that do a wonderful job, actually, of taking a book, and if you put it on the machine plate, it reads it to you. That's now been advanced to WhisperSync, which is the Kindle variant, which reads the book to you. You know, as long ago as 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, you actually had audio on your Windows. Most people didn't realize it. It was a little tiny microphone, and if you set it up, you could actually listen to the words that were being on the screen. But the words were kind of... so you didn't really want to listen to them.
Yeah.
But of course, like so many other things, they've improved that quality. It's still not what you would automatically choose to do. But it is possible now to listen on your Microsoft Word or one of the other systems, Apple, and get audio off of the screens and have it read to you.
John Schwartz.
But still, I don't think I want Siri reading these books to me.
Well put.
Good point. And I want to hear one last special clip, and then, Catherine, I'd like you to talk about it.
I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox slips and the nodding violet grows, quite over canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine. There sleeps Titania some time of the night, lulled in these flowers with dances and delight. And there the snake throws her enameled skin, weed wide enough to wrap a fairy in. And with the juice of this, I'll streak her eyes and make her full of hateful fantasies.
John Gielgud reading from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Catherine.
Yes, that is from a collection of Shakespeare speeches that he did called Ages of Man. And I listened to that starting at about age 11 or 12. And hearing it now, it's hard not to imagine falling in love with that language and becoming intoxicated by it. And that was my first real true exposure to Shakespeare as a child. And listening to a man with such a sort of laser-like intelligence, who understands every single word of what he is saying and is saying it in such a beautiful, you know, intelligent way, helped me approach reading Shakespeare in the printed form.
Really?
As a child. Yes, it made it much less intimidating because I felt like I had an ally. I felt like I was already on my home ground, so to speak, because I would listen to these recordings of him and other actors reading Shakespeare and poetry. It opened up just whole new worlds to me as a reader.
John.
Well, hearing language like that, the human factor coming in, just knowing that there's a human being listening and intelligently interpreting for you, it makes all the difference in the world.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Traverse City, Michigan. Carrie, you're on the air.
Thanks, Diane, and I want to thank your guests, too. It's a great topic. It actually touches a special spot in my heart because I actually can't read books very easily because what I do for work, I read all day long, every day. So if I were to want to read a book, I would have to read every waking moment of my life. So while I work, mow, shovel the driveway, whatever it is, I've always got a book going or a podcast. And I wouldn't be able to do that without any audiobooks. And the cadence is very important to me. Some of them I can do some things with a certain cadence, and sometimes I can't do something with a certain cadence. So one of your guests also touched on that point. And I also, it's not just for readers. I was never a reader in school, so this opened it up to me. So I can read. I'm too active to, you know, sit down and read a book.
Yeah, that's very interesting, not being a reader in school and then being turned on by audiobooks.
It's a great way to get into something, and we had a son who was having trouble starting a book, and we ended up starting him on Frankenstein as an audiobook, and then he moved through it. But you know, we were saying, why haven't you started this yet? Why haven't you started? Yeah. He didn't have a disability; he just wasn't getting off the dime, huh. And so we bought the audiobook, and I think it helped.
Well, you know, that brings me full circle. Peter S. knows. What does this boom in audiobooks mean for traditional publishers like yourself?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, people reading in all formats are a good thing. And the more books are available, the more likely they are to be read. And one of the things we found is that people are using these new technologies in ways that they didn't previously because they didn't have access to it. So, for example, the e-reader tends to produce books, people reading in larger numbers on an annual basis than they did before. And I think that's true of audiobooks as well. I think the fact that audiobooks are no longer a cumbersome business of large boxes of,
right.
of cassettes, as I said, that were more expensive than the printed book, was a deterrent. And I think that has changed now that the downloads are possible. I think the more that you can read, the more that's available, the more likely you're going to read. The more, as one of your callers said, the more you can activate your mind while you're doing other things, mowing, especially in a universe in which we spend so much time looking at screens. I think it's really actually been a tremendous asset to both information and literature.
And finally, to you, Michelle, what do you see as the future of audiobooks?
Well, we're definitely going to be producing more, more, more. And, you know, I will say we've talked a lot about downloads, but the CD is still alive and kicking. And certainly the libraries where many people go to listen and to find something to listen to are still active, heavily active in the CD. But I think our goal overall as audio publishers is to make more titles available, make them available more easily. You know, we all have smartphones now. If we can get them really seamlessly to the smartphone, we know then that people standing in line at the post office or stuck at the dentist's office waiting to have that cavity drilled are going to take time to really enjoy a book.
Well, I have so enjoyed this morning's conversation. Thanks to all of you. Michelle Cobb, president of the Audio Publishers Association. Peter Osnos, founder and editor at large of Public Affairs Books. Catherine Kellgren, an award-winning audiobook narrator. And John Schwartz of the New York Times. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.